This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. I'm pleased to have in the studio with me today Anna Baltzer. She's the author of Witness in Palestine, A Jewish-American Woman in the Occupied Territories. It's an incredible book with incredible photographs and texts. Anna Baltzer, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks so much for having me, Matt.
Well, how'd you decide to become a witness in Palestine?
I don't know if one decides to be a witness. One sort of becomes a witness, sometimes involuntarily. I first decided to go to Palestine after actually meeting Palestinians traveling through the Middle East on backpacking trips. I went through Iran and Syria and Lebanon, and when I started to meet Palestinian refugees, I started to hear for the first time a very different version of the history and present of the conflict, and that's what prompted me to want to go and see with my own eyes. And when I did witness what I did, I was compelled to tell others and to work for justice.
Well, what struck you immediately when you got to Palestine?
What struck me most of all was the segregation, that in the West Bank where I went, there was separate roads, one kind of road for Israelis, one kind for Palestinians. The Israelis living in the area are Jewish Israelis living in settlements. The Palestinians are in the area are Muslim and Christian. So essentially I saw a system of one kind of road for Jewish people, one kind for Muslims and Christians, one kind of legal system and housing and rights for Jews, and one kind of legal system and housing and rights for Muslims and Christians. As a Jewish person, especially given the history of social justice in Jewish communities, including my own, this was really hard for me to take. And I at first wanted to justify it with security, but seeing the way it manifests, I could no longer justify it.
Part of your book, Witness in Palestine, deals with your wrestling with that conflict and tension. And you write at the very beginning of your book, Witness in Palestine, that your grandmother lost many of her direct family members in the Holocaust. And so you were sensitive to that. And she was a Zionist, I take it. And you write that you felt that if you criticized Israel, you were betraying her. How'd you get past that?
I think ultimately, as I get more knowledgeable, I realize more and more that what I'm doing is, in many ways, because of what I learned from my grandmother, that I have in large part from her, a real sense of nobody's rights should be violated. People who are oppressed need to be, we need to speak out against that. And even if it's unpopular, even if it's dangerous for us, whatever it may be. So although it is true that my grandmother would never necessarily have embraced the Palestinian cause, it doesn't mean that I think it was inconsistent with what she taught me. So I think it was part of how I was raised. This was just kind of a blind spot, as it is for, I think, many Jewish people, especially in this country. And I think that's largely because of misinformation, that once people have the information, we can see the inconsistencies between what we believe and what Jewish people have fought for so long and what Israel is doing, which has nothing to do with Judaism.
But tell me more about that blind spot, because it seems to me that it's not just failure to get the information, though the media in this country is very biased against Palestinians. But there is a defensiveness among many Jewish Americans when presented with the evidence, when presented with a counter narrative about what's going on. They just don't want to hear it.
Yeah. Yeah. And my personal belief is that Zionism is fueled by fear, by an understandable fear founded on persecution of Jewish people, and that victimhood really passes through generations. I mean, I'm a generation that, you know, I'm two generations removed from the Holocaust, and yet there is some, my grandmother and my relationship with her were very formative for me in who I am. So there's a sense that, you know, we used up our patience with being a minority in a land that there is a real need to be a majority somewhere, the problem is that, first of all, the notion that there should be a state for Jewish people, and Judaism is a religion and it's a bloodline, an ethnic lineage, basically. The idea that there should be a state in which your place in that society is linked to your religion, your ethnicity, is fundamentally problematic. It also is not necessarily combating anti-Semitism. In many ways, it's actually accommodating anti-Semitism, saying, well, okay, well, all the Jews will just leave, and go and make our own place. But more importantly than the sort of, inherent issues with an ethnocentric nationalism is the fact that creating a Jewish majority to create Israel required removing the Muslim and Christian population. There was simply not a Jewish majority there. And so, for me, the idea that in order to create a place for our diaspora, we needed to create an entirely new diaspora, that, you know, finding a place where our culture and religion was accepted meant cleansing really an area of another culture and religion, that is unacceptable to me.
Anna Baltzer, a lot of people still cling to the myth that actually the Palestinians left, or they were ordered by their own people to leave, and so there was no ethnic cleansing.
Yes, this is certainly repeated a lot. It is no longer repeated by historians, because among historians, there is relatively consensus on this issue. The thing is that the myths surrounding 1948 and Israel's creation were essentially that Palestinians left on their own accord. They left in order to facilitate throwing Jews into the sea, etc. These things were accepted until the 1980s, when Israel's archives were opened up and people could actually look into the testimonies of Israeli soldiers, Zionist soldiers, what those soldiers were told to do, what the plans had been. And at this point, we can see precisely what soldiers were told to do, what they did do, and that was a systematic process of removing the population from the area. And so this is not something, I mean, people can debate this, but this is a matter of historic fact. I mean, just kind of like in An Inconvenient Truth, where there's a comparison between how many in the media agree with global warming versus scientists, and maybe it's half and half in the media, but among the scientists, there's no question.
I'm speaking with Anna Baltzer. She's the author of Witness in Palestine, a Jewish-American woman in the occupied territories. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor of the Progressive Magazine. Anna, when you started to speak out after doing some writing, you were hit with the all-too-familiar charge that you're a self-hating Jew. How do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, as I said before, what I'm doing is what it means to be Jewish. I mean, take Passover, for example, a liberation ritual that Jews have done, dedicated to remembering our oppression and then preventing it in the future. I mean, Judaism, to me, is really about struggling for social justice. Not that we have a monopoly on it. I mean, of course, others struggle for social justice, too. So what I'm doing is not at all contrary to Judaism. It's it's consistent with it. And this is an important thing non-Jews in particular to remember, and that is because a lot of times people are charged with anti-Semitism, and frankly, what Israel is doing, occupation, oppression, racial discrimination, these things have nothing to do with Judaism. And to speak out against them, likewise, is simply not anti-Jewish. It's not anti-Semitic. It's in line with a tradition of social justice, like I said. And I hope that people who have been attacked, that can be an empowering sort of way of looking at it. People will be attacked as long as this remains an unpopular stance. But as a Jewish American, and I hope many others will join me in saying this, it is not anti-Semitic to speak out against Israel's attacks on other human beings.
We got hit with that at the Progressive. I did personally. I'm a Jewish American too, and I criticized Israel's invasion of Gaza, and we got a lot of cancellations. They said this is just anti-Semitism, and I tried to say, you know, let's draw some basic distinctions here. You know, criticizing the policies of the state of Israel if you cut it clearly, it doesn't mean you don't want Israel to exist. It certainly doesn't mean that you are criticizing Jews. There's no equation between being a Jew and being a supporter of every repressive policy of the state of Israel. So that's a, it's a hard sell, though, for some people in this country, that's for sure. I want to get back to the book itself, Witness in Palestine, because what is so astonishing about this book to me and so persuasive is the stories you tell, just the real reporting, right on the ground floor stories. And I'm wondering if there is a story that in the book that was particularly gripping to you or just tear-jerking?
There are many. It's a long period of time. I'll just tell you the first one that comes to my mind. Actually, there's a few I'm choosing between. My friend Dawood, he's an English teacher in a village that we used to go and monitor the school in. Actually, we would stand in a bus stop outside of their boys' school where their young boys went to school. It's a village called Karawa Bani Zayt. And the reason we would stand there is because the army would come by precisely at the time when recess was called at the boys' school, and they would come by and they would throw in sound bombs or in tear gas into the school complex. And the young boys, when they would see the army coming, would pick up stones and throw stones at the jeep that was invading their village. And so we would come there as a presence to document what was happening, and if soldiers were about to invade the school, we would actually try and stop them. So I met Dawood then. That was several years ago. And then I saw him again about a year ago. And he called me crying when I was in Palestine, crying because his six-month-old son had had an asthma attack the night before. And so, like in the past, he was having an asthma attack. They wanted to bring him to an oxygen tent at the nearest hospital. But unfortunately, this asthma attack happened overnight, and a lot of the checkpoints in the West Bank separating villages from their hospitals, a lot of them are simply closed overnight. And so if you're having to use the Palestinian roads and there are roadblocks or there are checkpoints that are closed, too bad. Too bad you can't get to the hospital. And so his six-month-old son died in his arms in their car in the middle of the night of something preventable. And of course, these things are happening every day. It means all the more when it's someone who you knew and who you know, a friend of yours. But it's just one example of the atrocities of everyday life for Palestinians. I mean, what these checkpoints do, separating people from their schools, their jobs, making it so you cannot reliably do anything. You can't hold a steady job. You can't reliably get to school. You can't necessarily get an education. Your teachers can't get to school either. It breaks down all of Palestinian society. And in emergency cases, it's all the more dramatic when people can't get to the hospital. So that's just one of many pervasive parts of everyday life, things that oftentimes are not bloody enough to make the news, but are probably an even bigger part of the daily humiliation and pressure on Palestinians really to leave their land, submit to this pressure to Judaize the area.
A similar case was the case you told about the pregnant woman with twins who couldn't get to the hospital and lost both twins within a day of delivering.
Every day these things are happening. Mm.
I was also struck by the sadism of some of the guards. There's a guard, you tell the story, this is an Israeli soldier who shoots a Palestinian in the hand and then shoots him in the foot because he's not, you know, moving away fast enough. And he thought obviously that they wanted to kill him. And that goes on too. And you had a lot of confrontations with Israeli soldiers. How would they react when you were with a solidarity group? You weren't with the ISM, International Solidarity Movement, or were you?
I was with the International Women's Peace Service, which does similar work.
And so you'd go up to these Israeli soldiers, and how would they respond when you would challenge them?
So Israelis, like any population, are diverse. The soldiers, since there's a draft, they're coming from all walks of society. And surely if you put a gun in every high school graduate's hand and tell them that these people are your enemy and that they are out to kill you, some of them are going to be extremely violent and act what appears, at least for me, irrationally. Sure, there sadist soldiers. There were others who just felt that they were following orders. Neither of those things is acceptable, of course. The real issue being that there are soldiers there to begin with, not whether they're sadistic or whether they happen to be what they would call a humane soldier. But the idea that there should be people monitoring a Palestinian on their own land going from their town to another city, to go from their house to their sister's house, that there should be Israeli soldiers invading the area there to begin with. And so I would go, for example, to Checkpoint Watch with the group, and we would document the situation. Sometimes there would be violations we would document, aside from the entire violation of there being a checkpoint. And the way that soldiers would react, some would be rude, some would flirt with me. I mean, want to practice their English, which of course I wouldn't engage in any kind of conversation with them. But in general, the answer to the question is that I was surrounded with a bubble of privilege from the moment I arrived to the moment I left. That our mere presence, one of the reasons we're invited to be there, is that having the presence of a white person, an American, and if they know that I'm Jewish, a Jewish person can actually be a deterrent to violence. And so, you know, sure, there have been cases like Rachel Corey, who was bulldozed by an American-made bulldozer driven by an Israeli soldier in Gaza several years ago. There have been internationals targeted and Jewish people targeted, but for the most part, we are not targeted. For the most part, we get kind of the light harassment. And same goes actually here, that in the U.S. I'm invited all over the country, all over the world, to tell Palestinian stories. Palestinians aren't invited as much, at least, to tell their stories.
Well, it's a tension, Anna Balcher, then, that bubble of privilege, and it puts you in an uncomfortable position. How do you wrestle with that one?
I keep wrestling. That, I mean, I haven't really resolved things. One thing I do is ask Palestinians, you know, the idea that I can even go to Israel, Palestine, that, you know, that is a privilege that many Palestinians around the world cannot do, that I can go to one of those destroyed villages and the people who own the land there can't, that I, as a Jewish person, can go to Israel, I can buy their land, lease their land, farm their land, build a house on their land. If their house is there, I can live in their house on their land. They can't even visit. I mean, that is privilege. And so what I usually do is I ask them, you know, do you want me to use my privilege to go there to document, or should I reject my privilege, which seems more honorable? And they're like, why are you worried about this? Just go, just do this, you know, help us. They tend to be a lot more forgiving and tolerant than I am, even of myself. So that's part of how I cope with it. And I think it's not something we should ever become too comfortable with. We should keep asking ourselves those questions and make sure, because it's very easy to slip into being, to really reinforcing racist things. For me to use the fact that I'm Jewish to talk about this issue is, on the one hand, good because it's opening people's eyes. People who wouldn't otherwise listen are listening, but it's also reinforcing this idea that it takes a Jewish person in order for these things to be taken seriously. No, you know, Palestinians are the experts and they need to be listened to.
By the same token, that can paralyze you too, that wrestling. And it's better, in my view, to act and speak out than to worry yourself into paralysis.
Sure. Well, I'm obviously not paralyzed. I keep going.
You still have your voice. That's a great thing. Another thing that comes through in this book, Witness in Palestine, by Anna Balcher, my guest is.
Can I throw in my website at some point? If people do want to either write me or see the book or DVD, they're on my website, which is annainthemiddleeast.com. So ANNA in the Middle East, all one word, .com.
The thing that struck me also in your photos, you're a great photographer. You've been a photographer forever?
No, I just... The images are powerful because what's happening is powerful.
And you document with hundreds of photos the stories that you are telling. One of those stories is the uprooting of olive groves, which is expressly prohibited, by the way, in the Old Testament. And this is done by Israeli soldiers and by settlers?
That's correct. And by contractors, by the way. Sometimes they'll even contract firms that have hired Palestinian workers. You find Palestinian citizens of Israel, for example, uprooting their Palestinian brothers and sisters' trees.
That must be brutal for them.
I can only imagine. Yeah.
And what is the purpose of this?
A lot of times it's done to clear the area for the expansion of a settlement, for example. Other times it's done to clear for the expansion of the wall. Sometimes it's used as a form of punishment, collective punishment. Once we were called at 11 at night because down the road at another village, apparently a kid had thrown a rock at a settler driving by on the Israeli-only road that cuts through their village, and therefore the army came and uprooted 17 olive trees from the village, olive trees that belonged to an elderly family in the area. This was their livelihood. It had nothing to do with the boys, and it was collective punishment. And of course, the boys were never actually held. You know, there was no trial or anything. Anyway, they actually cut up every one of the trees to make sure that they could never be replanted. Other times, we've seen them actually come and steal the trees, and they'll replant them in settlements. They're very aesthetic and, you know, nice. It's nice to have an old olive tree. So they'll actually steal these trees and replant them in Jewish areas where they can, you know, appreciate this nice historic olive tree. Well, olive trees aren't history for us. We're Palestinians. They're their history, they're their presence, and they're their future. And uprooting their future like that is so symbolic. It destroys the land, too. I mean, environmental issues are a big thing with the wall, uprooting more than a million fruit trees for the path of the wall, not even including the other parts of the occupation. And the settlers not only taking the trees, but I've seen cases where settlers went down and poisoned the land around a village to prevent Palestinians from going to their land with their animals, with their sheep, so that they could expand onto that land.
You have an incredible picture of blue poisoned barley seeds at the root of some of these trees or in the grass so that the sheep would eat them and die, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, the idea is to push Palestinians off. If Palestinians don't go to their land for long enough, you know, the Israeli army will come in or the settlers and say, well, look, nobody else is using it. Now it's ours. And so it's a constant struggle for Palestinians. And to me, one type of resistance really is the decision by a shepherd. And I saw this with my own eyes when we went down there to in solidarity with the farmers to take poison out of the land, was deciding to go there. Even though she knew there was probably poison left over, she said, you know, if I don't come here, the settlers will get exactly what they wanted and they will come and they will take my land. And I'm coming back to show that I have a right to be here, even if I might lose one of my sheep. You know, that to me is a real resilience, a real resistance. And, you know, there's a different example where it was simply too much for the village, another environmental issue where there was a small village called Wadi Kana, which was surrounded by hilltops, each capped with a different settlement. And the settlements would actually direct their sewage down the valley into this village, which became basically just a pool of feces and urine. Eventually, the villagers had to evacuate. And to this day, it remains empty. They've become refugees once over. And so, I mean, the environmental destruction is another thing, not sensationalistic enough to show up in the media, but it's a huge issue.
A real metaphor of the relationship between settlers and Palestinians, too. Anna Balzer, can you elaborate on resistance? You talk about nonviolent resistance going on every day. We don't hear much about that.
That's right. People wonder, well, Why aren't they acting like Gandhi or Martin Luther King? And the answer is that there are a lot of Palestinians engaged in nonviolent resistance, really the majority of them. There is a lot of civil disobedience, a lot of nonviolent demonstrations in places like Bilayin, which is a Palestinian village where they've been holding nonviolent demonstrations every Friday for more than 4 years. That means more than 200 demonstrations where people are the army comes in, they take people away. They imprison people. They torture people. They intentionally target leaders of nonviolent resistance because, of course, the most dangerous thing would be for Palestinians to show to the world and the brutality of Israel's actions by exposing the way that this is not about security but rather about brutal colonialism. So there are places like Bilayin with very creative, artistic, empowering kinds of resistance through demonstrations. There are boycotts within Palestine and then now an international movement around the world to support that boycott, to stop buying Israeli products or stop buying U.S. products that profit off of the occupation, as well as divesting from those kinds of companies. It's Hampshire College, which was the first U.S. college to divest from apartheid South Africa, recently became the first U.S. college to divest from Israel. History is in the making. This is a growing movement, and I encourage people to look into it in their own communities. And there's all different kinds. To me, you know, that shepherd going to her land, the kids that wake up at 3:30 in the morning because they have to go through two checkpoints in the wall to get to school, but they still do it there and back, because they insist on getting an education. That is resistance, and it's nonviolent. We just don't hear about it.
Speaking with Anna Balzer, she's the author of Witness in Palestine, A Jewish American Woman in the Occupied Territories. Her website, annainthemiddleeast.com. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Well, let's take it a step further, though, because another interesting philosophical issue in this is whether to use violence or not, or whether violence is acceptable. Violence from throwing rocks to becoming a suicide bomber, and you interview a member of the Al-Aqsa Brigade, and you get his side of things. And I'm wondering how you come to terms with all that.
Well, I think one thing that becomes clear when you actually are in a situation of violence, you know, it's easy to be a pacifist when your life is very pleasant. We think, well, I don't believe in violence. Well, someone came into your home and started taking out your television and your bed and then your car and then, I don't know, your refrigerator. At some point, would you pick up a lamp and throw it at them? I mean, just the most basic idea that an invader coming into your land, you know, if let's say the entire United States were invaded by China and held under a foreign illegal military occupation, according to international law, we would have the right to militarily defend ourselves. We would have the right to use violence against the illegal military presence. We wouldn't have the right to go and kill Chinese civilians in China. So a lot of the violence used by Palestinians is against an illegal occupier and actually is protected under international law. Not only that, but really one thing that becomes clear there, besides the fact that it's just not realistic to expect people surrounded by incredible violence to respond 100% nonviolently, and besides the fact that it actually, when it's a targeting soldiers on Palestinian land, it's even protected by law.
Well, what would you do, though? I mean, if you took not those examples, but the suicide bomber in a Tel Aviv market.
Well, yeah, actually, but historically, Israel has, I think it's fair to say, Israel has actually responded more to violent resistance. In other words, the advances of nonviolent resistance have been targeted. Violent resistance, on the other hand, has been more responded to. For example, in Gaza, one of the main reasons I think that Israel withdrew its settlers from the Gaza Strip was because it was becoming too politically costly. A lot of the people being killed by Palestinians were settlers living vulnerably on somebody else's land. The main reason for Israel to withdraw from Lebanon decades ago, and then more recently in 2006, had to do with violence against them. So not only is it, you know, protected under law and understandable, but one cannot question why certain Palestinians find it more strategic. That said, though, attacks on civilians is not, in my opinion, acceptable in any case. But if we're going to talk about attacks on civilians, obviously we need to talk also about Israeli attacks on civilians. And you know, in the attack by Israel on Gaza, starting in late 2008 and continuing until January 2009, the ratio of Palestinians civilians to Israeli civilians who were killed was more than 100 to 1. I mean, it's just absurd to focus only on attacks on Israeli civilians when this violence is not something that's been going on forever and ever, but something that began with the imposition of a colonial state that excluded the indigenous population. And it's something we would see, I think, anywhere where people were being pushed out of their homes.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, Anna Balzer. I'd love to spend more time with you. Anna Balzer is the author of Witness in Palestine, A Jewish American Woman in the Occupied Territories. Her website, annainthemiddleeast.com. Thanks for being my guest.
Thanks so much for having me.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.